Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Rahul Mahajan, who looks at the inquiry into the Haditha massacre of Iraqi civilians and the incident's impact on the continued U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. George Christian of the Library Connection in Windsor, Connecticut, who explains why his group challenged the USA Patriot Act and his concern over the erosion of civil liberties in America. And Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, who discusses the deadly health consequences for women subjected to female genital mutilation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An Islamic militia has taken over Mogadishu, the war-torn capital of Somalia, after weeks of fighting with rival warlords that killed over 300 civilians. The militia, the Union of Islamic Courts, won popular support against the U.S.-backed secular warlords, the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace, who had run Mogadishu for the last 15 years. The Bush administration had sought to stop al-Qaeda fighters from gaining a sanctuary in the Horn of Africa. A decade earlier, the warlords had fought American peacekeeping troops, chronicled in the book and movie Black Hawk Down. As the Islamic forces gained control of the city, the BBC reported 9 of the 11 controlling secular warlords had fled Mogadishu. Many of the fighters for the warlords had switched sides and now backed the Union of Islamic Courts. According to the International Crisis Group, the anti-Islamic alliance backed by the Bush administration with millions of dollars of covert aid is on the run. The interim Somalia government based in Kenya is now seeking a peace deal with the Islamic militia. The BBC reported the militia has strong local support from business groups to create public order and restore Islamic or Sharia law in Somalia. An in-house audit by the World Bank's debt relief program showed that it has failed to put poor nations on a path toward economic growth. According to the Interpress Service, the relief provided for nearly a decade to highly indebted poor countries, or HIPC, has allowed 18 nations, mostly in Africa, to cut debt in half, but in 11 other nations, debt is rising again to pre-debt relief ratios. The HIPC program was started in the mid-1990s by the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and the wealthy industrial nations that make up the Paris Club, which provides aid to developing countries. At its 2005 meeting in Scotland, the leaders of the G8 agreed to cancel all debt to the most indebted nations in exchange for following a recovery program designed by the World Bank and IMF. The evaluation report pointed out the need for the World Bank to boost social spending in indebted nations aimed at reducing poverty. Global anti-poverty activists are advocating for an overhaul of international trade rules. Stephen Mandel of the London-based New Economics Foundation insisted poor nations could not prosper without a dramatic change in the trading relationship with rich nations, including ending massive farm subsidies in the United States and Europe. The Grist Online Environmental magazine reports that ethanol producers are increasingly looking to coal rather than cleaner natural gas to power ethanol plants. Energy consultant Robert McIlvain predicts a big switch to coal among the 190 ethanol plants now under construction due to coal's lower cost. A move to coal-powered ethanol plants would dramatically reduce the environmental benefits of using ethanol. According to a study at the University of California at Berkeley, corn-based ethanol produced by using natural gas reduced greenhouse emissions by 38% compared to gasoline. But the environmental benefit is cut in half when ethanol is made at coal-burning plants. In contrast, cellulosic ethanol, made from switchgrass and wood chips, reduces greenhouse gases by 88%, but is still in early development. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency, under pressure from conservative South Dakota Senator John Thune, has proposed a new rule to allow ethanol plants to double the amount of permitted emissions. As John Walk of the Natural Resources Defense Council stated, this proposal is clearly designed to usher in a whole new wave of coal-fired plants, loosening the rules so the facilities can be bigger, dirtier, and cheaper. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
A Pentagon inquiry into allegations that U.S. Marines executed 24 Iraqi civilians, including men, women, and children, in the town of Haditha last November, has triggered wider scrutiny of the conduct of U.S. forces in the war. A BBC report in early June presented video evidence of the possible murder of 11 Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops in the town of Ishaqi in March, but a Pentagon investigation recently cleared the American soldiers involved in the raid. The shooting deaths of a pregnant Iraqi woman and her cousin by U.S. troops in Samarra as they were driving to a hospital near a U.S. observation post on May 30th further aggravated the situation. Iraq's new prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, ordered his own investigation into the Haditha massacre and said that such abuses had become common among multinational forces. Al-Maliki, echoing the growing anger among many in his nation, stated that U.S. troops had no respect for Iraqi citizens, a situation, he said, that was unacceptable. Although U.S. forces recently underwent retraining in core warrior values, the Pentagon's decision to omit the Geneva Convention's explicit ban on humiliating and degrading treatment of detainees from an Army field manual has cast doubt on the Bush administration's commitment to human rights and international law. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Rahul Mahajan, who looks at the inquiry into the Haditha massacre and the incident's possible impact on the continuing U.S. war and occupation of Iraq.
The disintegration, the political deadlock, the amazing escalation in intersectarian warfare has been the focus of everyone for all this time, to the point that I think many people just sort of forgot about the ongoing U.S. military operations and what the troops might or might not be doing. It was looking like that was going to be the way things continued, and I think it was actually something that the anti-war movement was having a hard time dealing with in terms of mobilizing the public disaffection for the war into some kind of opposition. But I think what's happening now, the big story really is it's not new, you know. The Haditha massacre occurred back in November, and other incidents that are now being uncovered are also in the past and under investigation. But the story that people are being forced to confront now, that which they hadn't for a long time, which is that the United States is committing war crimes up to and including, in the case of Haditha, just a deliberate massacre of women and children. Some reporters who have finally been galvanized to cover the story in the sort of escalating cascade of events since John Murtha brought it to people's attention have also been digging into other things, perhaps the most interesting and important going back to the November 2004 assault on Fallujah, which was truly savage, in which several thousand people were likely killed, and looking at the rules of engagement there, which most likely, you know, sort of explicitly violated the Geneva Conventions. And I think there's real potential for restarting a dialogue about U.S. war crimes and about the sort of the moral case against the war.
How should the United States or the international community proceed in investigating these alleged war crimes in Haditha and elsewhere? Can the Pentagon be trusted to conduct these investigations impartially, given that there is some evidence that these incidents, initially at least, were covered up?
The Pentagon cannot be trusted, nor can the sort of the individual branches which first see these cases. And in the case of the Marines, within 2 days they knew that the U.S. soldiers' story was a lie, but they didn't investigate this until Time magazine asked them about it and actually showed them video evidence. So they certainly cannot be trusted. Ideally, one would like an outside independent investigation into, you know, the way that the U.S. culture is an outside investigation in this case means that the Army is investigating the Marines rather than the Marines investigating themselves. But what one would really like was some body with some sort of international legitimacy. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And if it did, then you would just find the U.S. military at every turn blocking their ability to find out any kind of information and conduct a real investigation. So the Pentagon investigations are really untrustworthy and bad, but sometimes they are going to get at the truth. And in the case of Haditha, it's almost certain something is going to happen, if only because this Iraqi journalism student, who narrowly escaped being massacred himself, got evidence of the corpses and their close-up execution-style killing on video. And I think one of the things that needs to be done right now is to really put out a call for people to to come forward with evidence of any other kinds of atrocities to have them investigated as well. If there is enough of a groundswell politically, and if there is enough incontrovertible evidence like some of this video, then even the Pentagon trying to cover things up will be forced to act.
With the headlines in the United States, and I'm certain in Iraq as well, discussing the Haditha massacre, what do you think will be the impact in Iraq itself, as well as here in the United States?
Well, the first thing to understand is that to Iraqis, the Haditha massacre is not news. It doesn't mean anything. Most of them assume that U.S. troops deliberately murder civilians at times when they feel like it. And furthermore, they don't make distinctions in the same sort of way that Americans have been conditioned to make them by our culture and by the propaganda that we get. So for them, for example, cordoning off the city of Fallujah, a city of hundreds of thousands of people, and bombarding it ceaselessly, and then moving in an invasion and killing probably several thousand people, is a much bigger crime than going into several houses and murdering 24 people. On this scale, they say, these things happen every day. And killing a pregnant woman going into labor and her mother at a checkpoint is, well, the civilians are dead, whether they were killed, quote, deliberately by Marines going in and shooting people point blank, or killed at a checkpoint because people got touchy and have rules of engagement and culture of engagement that says shoot first and ask questions later. I don't think Iraqis distinguish very much on that, so it won't mean very much. What might mean something to them is really serious sentences for the people who committed this crime, and especially sentences for higher-up officers at ranks that have not yet been held accountable for any atrocities. I think Haditha has the real potential to be the meal eye of this war. In the Vietnam War, what happened in 1969 when the My Lai massacre broke, it was a huge revelation for ordinary Americans about just how immoral the Vietnam War is and about what kind of atrocities were being committed there by American soldiers. I think the same thing could happen with Haditha. It has the same sort of quality. It's the same sort of deliberate, cold-blooded murder, although it's on a smaller scale as everything in this war is. And it is being picked up. People are paying attention, and I think it's actually a very important time for the anti-war movement to really try to consider how to make Haditha into the My Lai of this war, because it is that important and because it is actually a necessary part of building meaningful opposition to the war.
That was Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, published by Seven Stories Press. Read Mahajan's commentaries online at www.empirenotes.org. George Christian, executive director of the Library Connection in Windsor, Connecticut, received an ominous call and later a national security letter from the FBI last summer demanding the records of library patrons related to a federal investigation. National security letters, established under the post 9/11 USA Patriot Act, authorized the FBI to secretly obtain credit and library records without judicial oversight and regardless of the target's involvement in illegal activity. The provision also imposes a gag rule on those served with the letters. Some 30,000 national security letters are issued by the government each year. Christian and three officers from his organization, represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, decided to challenge the government's right to silence their ability to publicly express opposition to the Patriot Act. In September 2005, U.S. District Court Judge Janet Hall ruled in favor of the librarians, collectively known then as John Doe. She said the law has the practical effect of silencing individuals with a constitutionally protected interest in speech and whose voices are particularly important in an ongoing national debate about the intrusion of government authority into individual lives. However, Judge Hall's ruling was put on hold by a Justice Department appeal. But in late May, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed the government's petition and let Judge Hall's ruling stand, allowing the librarians to speak out for the first time. Although Congress revised portions of the Patriot Act, many civil libertarians continued to see dangers in the legislation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with George Christian of the Library Connection about why his group challenged the Patriot Act and his concern over the erosion of civil liberties in America.
I think, and I think most librarians think, that free public libraries are a cornerstone of democracy. There are places where the citizen can go to inform himself of the issues of the day, not only political issues, but all kinds of issues. And the idea that government, like Big Brother, could be looking over their shoulder is just chilling. I think it would make people think twice, whether it's a business person or a traveler who wants to read up on the Middle East before they go there or do business there and don't want anyone to misconstrue their interest in the Middle East, or whether it's a woman who has concerns about breast cancer and wants to inform herself without necessarily letting the greater community know that these are her concerns. These people should not be at all reluctant to use a library with the understanding that they can do so in strictest confidence.
There is a fight against terrorism, of course, and going through September 11th, a lot changed in this country. But do you think library records have a central role or even a peripheral role in fighting the war against terrorism?
It's a complex question. The way I would approach it, it is to keep in mind Benjamin Franklin's caution that those who would sacrifice liberty in order to gain security will end up with neither. I think I'm a patriot in as much as the next person, if not more. When you're inducted into the armed forces, you swear to protect the Constitution, not the president or the FBI or the attorney general. And I'm trying to protect the Constitution here. I do believe that the FBI and other law enforcement authorities have a legitimate role in protecting the citizenry against terrorism, and that may mean that there are times when they do need to find out what has happened at a library. But there are legitimate ways to ask for that information. There's judicial review. They can go get a subpoena or a warrant in which a judge says, yes, looking at the evidence, you have probable cause to go down this road, and I will authorize you to do so. They can't just sign a letter on a whim and start poking around.
How did you come to decide as a group, you and the other three librarians in the consortium, how did you decide to take on this Patriot Act law? It must have been a big step, and I also think that maybe you had some concerns, too, about what kind of personal jeopardy you were putting yourself in as you opposed the government policy.
When I realized that it was possible to seek legal redress from complying with the national security letter, I also realized that I had no right to commit my corporation to such a step, especially when the only way we could do it was a lawsuit against the Attorney General of the United States. Even though the national security letter forbade me from conferring with anyone, I felt it was necessary to get permission or at least acquiescence in doing this, and I decided rather than inform the entire board of directors, I would inform the three officers who comprise the executive committee. They are all library directors. They all felt exactly the same way I did and wanted to explore pursuing this as much as they could.
Do you think people in this country, library patrons in particular, you think they're as concerned about this issue as they should be?
I think they are when they're informed. But most people just assume that what's in a library is confidential. 48 of our 50 states have state statutes declaring library records to be confidential and enjoining librarians to ensure that they remain that way. No one ever dreamed that the federal government would come in and try and trump state statutes.
I had read in a press report that you have a history of activism during the Vietnam War era, being a conscientious objector during that conflict. How do you see the bridge between, you're taking a stand back then during Vietnam and what you stuck your neck out very obviously to do here?
I don't see any relationship between the two except that I'm obviously willing to put my feet down when I think I'm doing the right thing. And that's what I feel I'm doing here. If I'm surprised at all, I'm surprised that there are only two cases that have legally protested the receipt of a national security letter with all this volume. I'm just absolutely flabbergasted. What people have to do is start writing their congressmen and threatening to vote the way they're writing and saying that, yes, we want security, but not at the cost of liberty.
That was George Christian, executive director of the Windsor, Connecticut Library Connection. For more information on challenges to the USA Patriot Act, contact the American Library Association by calling 1-800-545-2433 or visit their website at www.ala.org. Million women and girls worldwide have undergone genital cutting, also known as female genital mutilation, or FMG. Now, the first comprehensive medical study of the procedure has revealed that the chances of a woman or her baby dying during childbirth increases by 50% for those women who have been subjected to this cultural ritual. The cutting can range from a small snip to the tip of the clitoris to massive cutting of the external genitalia and the stitching together of what remains, leaving only a tiny opening to pass urine and menstrual blood. It is carried out mostly on young girls, often under unsanitary conditions and often without anesthesia, resulting in pain, massive bleeding, and infection, setting the stage for tragedy when the women bear children. The study was conducted from 2001 to 2003 among 28,000 women in six African countries by a study group of the World Health Organization. Sudan had the highest rate of FMG at 83%, while Ghana had the lowest at 40%. The study surveyed only women who gave birth in a medical setting, thus excluding millions of women who give birth at home and have an increased chance of losing their babies or dying due to infection or other complications. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. She explains what happens when a woman who's undergone FMG gives birth and describes how the politics and the players involved in the struggle to end this practice have changed over the past three decades.
I first was exposed to female genital mutilation in the Sudan in 1973. You know, that's 33 years ago. Both the politics of the issue and action on the issue have changed a great deal since then. In the 70s, you could not, as an outsider to the countries where it's practiced, you could not talk about it. It was considered to be a sacrosanct cultural practice. And through the 80s, that was largely true. But African women themselves began to mobilize around this issue. And they were joined, especially in the early 90s, by medical professionals as well from those countries who really were more and more concerned about the consequences of FGM.
Can you explain exactly what happens during childbirth to a woman who has undergone the more radical of the procedures, the woman who's been cut and then sewn shut?
The traditional birth attendant, for example, would use a razor blade or a stone or some other sharp object actually to cut the woman open again during childbirth. For somewhat less extreme procedures, what happens during childbirth is that the baby during birth basically tears through the scarring and the tissue that has been previously cut. So a great deal of damage can be done because of the force of the birth process on top of the original cutting.
Adrienne Germain, can you describe some of the organizing that's gone on in the past 15 or 20 years to confront this process?
By the early 90s, as more and more women in Africa questioned the process and health providers were seeing more women who were coming out from their homes and getting to hospitals, there began to be a wider questioning in the African countries themselves about this practice. Then women began to organize, and whole organizations came up to press for changes in the law to ban it, and many countries have now made it illegal. At the same time, these organizations worked from the ground up to help communities understand why this is so dangerous and therefore why they should not do this to their daughters. But that kind of cultural change takes a great deal of time and effort. And so, of course, the practice still goes on. And in some instances, it goes on among families that have left Africa and moved to other countries, the UK, the Netherlands, the United States.
What's been going on at the international level?
The World Health Assembly, which is the meeting of all the world's health ministers, they meet every year at the World Health Organization. And in, I believe it was the late 90s, they passed a resolution against female genital mutilation as a health, major health problem. Now, that was a politically very, very important step. It was the first time at the global international level that female genital mutilation had been recognized as a major public health issue. And it was done without having the kind of data that come from this study. But even though we've had that World Health Assembly resolution, we still have had to continue working and working and working, especially at the grassroots level, to persuade families and communities, and then even also at the national level in countries, to persuade them to implement the law. It's vitally important that, for the most part, the people who work directly in these countries on the issue are, in fact, African. This has been a transformation from the early days, and it's just very, very important that it's Africans working in their own countries on the issue. The issues also arise in countries where migrants go. It's very, very important not to somehow denigrate those women. It's something that happened to them, and they still needed to be treated with respect and understanding, as well as receive, you know, good medical care. What is very, very, very important for people to know is that this practice is in no way required under Islam. Even though it happens to a very large extent in Muslim societies, this is not a religious practice. This is a cultural practice. It is not religious. There is absolutely nothing in any interpretation of the Quran or the Hadith or any of the other laws and writings of Islam that in any way mandates this.
That was Adrienne Germain of the International Women's Health Coalition. Contact the coalition by calling area code 212-979-8500. Or visit their website at www.iwhc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.